Welcome, everyone. It's 2:45, so I'm going to get started. And for those of you who are new, I'll just say a brief word of introduction to myself and to the series I'm doing at Holden, and then launch in today's session, which is called Little House in the Suburbs. I'm Chris Sharon, and I teach and do research and writing at Auburn Seminary in New York. And I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. We can talk later about how that all works. And I'm doing this project partly because there's a moment in our country's history which really, I think, requires white people to struggle to tell more truthful stories, more complex stories about their own history. And the dynamic that's happening is we're shifting from a white majority to a white minority in our country over these decades that we're living through right now. It's probably already true if you look across the country in elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And by maybe 2040, 2045, it will be true of the whole population. And in the context of that, clearly there's a history of violence in relationship to African Americans, the history of slavery in the United States, and a history of violence in relationship to the native peoples. And that history of violence is in between the white settlers, the white colonists, and people of color. And so part of the argument I'm making is that telling stories about, especially, I think all of us need to tell stories, but especially for white people to tell stories about our white history will help us make that transition to being a minority in our country in a way that's more just and generous. And we'll get to that place, I think, by doing the work of telling our own story in a more complex and truthful way. And I happen to have, in my family tree, a really famous American pioneer settler, Laura Ingalls Wilder. And so I want to tell my story not only because of the convictions I have about this moment in the country, but because of the particular myth, the iconic myth that Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, Little House on the Prairie series, play in our culture. And the connection is my great-great-grandmother Lottie Charlotte Quiner was a double cousin with Laura. They were both born in Pepin, Wisconsin in 1867, grew up together there, reconnected later in the prairie in South Dakota, where Laura's family settled in DeSmet, and my family continued out to Keystone, South Dakota, which is where my grandma May was born. Then they continued out to Wyoming, where my dad was born and grew up. So this is partly an iconic American story. It's partly my story. And investigating it critically and confessionally is a way partly to tell stories that I belong to, but to invite you, to invite others to think through your own stories. Yesterday I did a sort of session engaging Pepin in 1867 when Laura and Lottie were born, Little House in the Big Woods. Today I'm doing a session around 1966, 100 years later, when I was born in a white suburb outside of Washington, D.C. So that's where we're going to go today, thinking about the 60s and what transpired through the 1950s and 60s that sets up some of the dynamics that we're dealing with in our country right now, which I think make it especially important to do this kind of work of storytelling. For me, it's important, and I invite you into that work as we talk, thinking about your own stories, how you see these from your perspective. So jumping into today's session. This is a map showing where Beltsville is. Beltsville, obviously, was a suburb that was built after the interstate highway system was built in many metropolitan areas like Washington, D.C., built a beltway so people in their cars could circumnavigate the city and not have to go through it. And so Beltsville was named literally because it was a suburb right on the beltway around Washington, D.C. In Prince George's County, Maryland. And that suburb, like many suburbs, was entirely white. It was a suburb that was built on the sort of wave of housing that was built, a sort of boom of house construction in suburbs that was launched probably starting in the late 40s at the end of World War II. And here's an advertisement for these beautiful new suburbs. My dad smoked a pipe, you know. Yep. They were a happy young couple. And their house is brick. I'll show you a picture of it in a minute. But this image up here, no down payment for veterans in many areas. So there was this very important connection. I was thinking about this today. Yesterday I talked about the Homestead Act and how the Homestead Act wasn't passed until 1862 because the concern was that it would not be available for Native and African American people, only whites. And there's an interesting parallel between the Homestead Act and the impact it had on expanding settlement and the GI Bill and its special provisions for people to buy houses. It worked. It gave low-income loans, very low or no down payment, and low interest rates. Maybe some of you, I don't know, is anyone here someone who benefited from the GI Bill in terms of buying a house back then?
Today.
Yeah. I was thinking in that era, but yeah. What's your experience now?
So you can still have no down payment. It was a really nice benefit.
Yeah, and it was used then by hundreds of thousands of returning soldiers from World War II. And I didn't know it was still operative in that way for housing. So that at the time drove the expansion of the suburbs. It's interesting that the suburbs got their start at the turn of the century as garden suburbs, as a part of a health movement. And there was this idea that inner cities didn't have good airflow, didn't have enough greenery, and were unhealthy. And when the trolleys were being installed in cities, they started to build little garden suburbs at the end of the trolley lines. And now most of those garden suburbs have been incorporated into the cities themselves, and so you can't really tell they were suburbs, but 100 years ago they were. And those neighborhoods often have curvy streets and lots of trees and little parks tucked into the... Anyone live in a garden suburb in a city around the United States? Those were the harbinger of these later suburban communities that were built. And the interesting... I mean, it's not surprising, really, that during the Great Depression and the early war years that there wasn't a lot of housing built. There just wasn't a lot of demand. People didn't have a lot of money. And so the number of new houses being built was relatively small. So after World War II, with the GI Bill and all these people coming back from military service, there was this huge demand for housing. And so you see things like this. This is, in the bottom corner, a picture of Levittown on Long Island, which became kind of a template for these copycat houses, just one after the other, in these cul-de-sac suburban communities. And they built maybe not even 300,000 houses a year in the U.S. in the pre-war years. And from like 1947 through the 50s, averaging 1.5 million new houses a year being built. So way, way, way more houses being built, mostly in this kind of a suburb. This is L.A., all these people moving in, just all the same day into their new houses. And this is not exactly my house, but this is a house just down the street from my little red brick suburban community in Prince George's County where I wasn't born there, but where I spent my early years. So there were dynamics that played into the way that these suburbs developed. One of them was the great migration of African Americans out of the Jim Crow South, away from lynching, away from the terrorism they experienced in the South to northern cities. And at the very same time, the building of these white suburbs. So many of, even though it wasn't always legal to have segregation in a strict sense, many of the deeds or community what's the word for it when you have covenants, community covenants, would write in something about who was welcome in terms of racial, ethnic identity. And so in a whole bunch of different ways, these communities assured that they were white communities. And that joint movement of the suburbs being built and the great migration of African Americans up into northern cities sort of played a role in the development of the suburbs. And so I think it's a feature I experienced. Like, I didn't know, I was in the DC metro area, I didn't know there were no people of color at all in our neighborhood, none. And there was one African American boy in my Prince George's County elementary school. So it was just my experience of growing up in an entirely white, very crisp, suburban brick house neighborhood, playing with my friends on the street. It ended in a park. And how many of you, I'm just curious, how many of you grew up in a suburb? What year do you think it was that a majority of Americans lived in suburbs? What would you guess?
1975.
I hear 75. Do I hear earlier?
65.
Do I hear earlier? Yeah, I read it was early 50s, because the move to build suburbs started in 47, 48, and it just went boom, you know, and so it's surprisingly early that suburbs became a dominant living reality for people in our country. The arc of where I want to go today is to make an argument about a particular trajectory of events in our country that sets up the dynamics that we're experiencing right now, and in the midst of that, I want to say something about why I think the Little House on the Prairie series, the TV show, started in the mid 70s. Why it fit right there, why it resonated so much there in our country's history. But I don't want to stop there. I want to keep going and trace sort of the impact of the 60s on the shaping of our country as it is now. So let's just brainstorm for a minute before I go any farther. The suburbanization really was a feature that started in the late 40s and 50s and kept going. But there are some distinct things but beyond that, in the 50s and 60s, that marked that time. And I just want to brainstorm with you, what do you think some of the most significant sort of cultural trends or cultural events were, movements that shaped that era in our country? What would you say?
Television?
Rock and roll?
Riots.
What's that?
Riots.
What? Say more about riots.
Well, let's see. There was the Lock Riots in Los Angeles in 1965, I think. There was other riots after Martin Luther King got shot.
Yeah, 68 riots in a number of cities.
Really made white people afraid of black people in a way they really haven't been before.
Yeah, and they played a significant role in urban experience and the national imagination about what was happening. Absolutely. Somebody over here. The Cold War, absolutely.
The pill.
The pill.
Yep.
Yeah, feminism connected to that. What's that?
Draft evaders.
Draft evaders and the whole context of the Vietnam War and protests against the Vietnam War. Absolutely. What else?
Baby boom.
The baby boom. What would you relate that to?
Not post-war prosperity.
Yeah. Yeah, the larger sort of, well, into the suburbs, whole interconnected set of things there. And that, interestingly, that connected to the vast expansion of higher education in the 60s and 70s. There was a huge growth, yeah, the GI Bill, there was a huge growth in going to college and kind of pursuit of the middle class life, the educated middle class life, yeah. What else?
I always thought that if the parents who grew up during the Depression had a huge impact on that era. They'd gone through the Depression, you know, that big success movement, moving up and into the suburbs, into a better life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to say consolidated school districts.
Huh.
So all the little neighborhoods districts started getting to be also public schools as opposed to smaller. They had more power when they were more up.
And that seems to me like the era when rural one-room schoolhouses also started to consolidate into community schools. Partly, I suppose, because of the building of highways and the sort of improvement of transportation, buses and all of that, cars. Yeah. Yeah, back here.
The rise of the automobile and kind of common public transportation.
Exactly. Building the freeway system. Yeah, and that went hand in hand with the suburbanization. I had this one. Well, you can see, every house there. This is unusual because it has a sidewalk, but many of the suburban communities have a driveway but no sidewalk. Just not so subtle signal about the importance of the automobile for that to happen. Tax deductions for mortgages. Interesting. Which, in a sense, was an incentive for this home ownership and,
farm mechanization made the small farm obsolete.
Farm, could you hear that? Farm mechanization made the small farm obsolete. And probably related to the expansion, the sort of corporatization of farms, the bigger and bigger farms. And probably monocropping, too, began more in that era. Somebody over here. Yeah.
And in terms of the family, not a lot of women worked outside of the home. So mom was always there when you got home from school. And...
Yeah, look what the woman's dreaming up here.
I just love it.
Yeah, if you want a painful laugh, look up pictures of advertising the suburbs, and you'll see a whole bunch of painful stereotypes. Well, yeah, please.
Fast food,
yeah. The first McDonald's and prepared meals, too. Convenience, TV dinners. That's right. Someone said television earlier. Yeah, Chuck.
Yeah, maybe a big swing towards independence, right? We each had our own car, had our own house, we could come and go, and much more mobility, and relying on ourselves rather than maybe the communities that used to be part of farm communities, or where you were more relying on one another.
Interesting.
A swing towards independence.
Yeah. And it plays a little bit different valence when you think about the hippie movement. The independence that was a part of that, the sort of dropout culture, that's a little later in the 60s, but it had also that kind of individualism, individual expressive perspective as a part of it. Well, I want to highlight a couple of the pieces that you've lifted up that I think create a context in which you can make some sense not only of the introduction of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House on the Prairie TV series starting in 1974, but also a sort of arc that leads us to the moment we're in right now and some of the larger dynamics that are impacting the country. And I want to highlight, first of all, movements, social movements, especially the civil rights. And the civil rights I want to highlight first, because it really started, if you think about the legal attacks on Jim Crow laws, the civil rights movement really started in the 30s and 40s. Thurgood Marshall was working on critiques case by case of Jim Crow laws throughout the 40s, starting in the 30s and 40s. And then what we think of as the civil rights movement starting in the 50s, maybe with the Montgomery bus boycott or something like that. And so it really was a something that built at the same time as this suburbanization process was happening. Here's some pictures from the civil rights movement. King and Abernathy in Montgomery, or in Birmingham, being arrested, and the Freedom Riders and Fannie Lou Hamer letting them have it. It's a really beautiful, powerful picture of her. And I think one of the most important features of the 1960s for understanding where we are today, no one mentioned, which I think is interesting. And it in part happened because of the civil rights movement. And I think making the case for that is really important. And that is the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which was signed by Lyndon B. Johnson on the statue, right at the base of the Statue of Liberty. And this is a picture of the signing that day in 1965. Some important features about that, it was officially called the Hart-Keller Act of 1965, and there was an Immigration Act of 1925 that radically shut down immigration from most countries in the world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Southern European and Eastern European countries. It only privileged, for immigration, it only privileged Northern Europeans. And there was a very sort of strong anti-immigrant wave that crashed across the country throughout the 30s and 40s. That's when in my family, part of my family is from German-speaking Switzerland and from Germany. They all stopped speaking German almost overnight in that period of time. And so my mom, growing up, didn't learn German. Her parents grew up speaking fluent German in the home. So there was this very strong anti-immigrant both law and cultural wave that was very important through that period. But by the time we got up into the 1950s, and the civil rights movement was going on, and there was international, the United Nations had been founded, and there was growing both national and international pressure for the U.S. to change its immigration policy that was really viewed as immoral, to be so biased against everyone except Northern Europeans. This is post World War II, so the whole specter of Nazism and the way that they privileged Aryan kind of view of human superiority was playing into that, as well as the domestic experience with the civil rights movement. And so it was President Truman who commissioned a study in 1952, and the study was called "Whom Shall We Welcome?" That was the name of the study, and it was a blueprint for this new Immigration Act, which opened up immigration to every part of the world. And it still had built in some numerical quotas, but it opened up immigration to everywhere in the world, and it had some features like privileging people with education or specific skills, those types of things. So it still had some provisions. But look what happens to the overall immigration. This huge number of, this is the percentage of the total pop, or the total number of immigrants, and then this is the share of the U.S. population up here. This huge decline that starts after 1920, dipping all the way down until in 1960, 1970, when this act passed, it turns around and just starts boomeranging back up. So that graph tells a profound story, not only about where we've been, but it also says something really interesting about where we're going, where we are now, and where we're going. So one really important feature, I think, of where we are as a country is the changing population because of that single piece of legislation and the dynamics that it unleashed. For example, you could think in sheer population numbers, but it also introduced much more religious diversity to the U.S. People from Southeast Asia with many different religious traditions. I just think about my own community in the Twin Cities. We have much, much more religious diversity than a generation ago or two generations ago, partly because exactly of this change in the law about who can come. So that's, I think, a really key, and I'll come back to it, come back to this later, but a key shift in the character of what the country is, who's here, and in the end, who votes. Then I want to say something about other movements that were happening during the 60s and a particular trajectory about that that leads to, I think, some of the dynamics of what happened in the 1970s. These are some pictures of the women's movement and the farm worker movement and the gay liberation movement and the anti-Vietnam protests and the free love movement, the hippies dropout. What was that phrase? Make love, not war. But there's dropout, tune in, turn. We're going to get it.
Turn on, dropout.
Yeah, that's it. And then the whole, so all of this movement stuff is happening. Assassinations are happening. What's your name, sir? Dave mentioned the assassination of King, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, all these dynamics, the riots that happen in urban centers across the country. So all of this going on. And then the Vietnam War just dragging on and on. And then Watergate. So just an incredible moment of upheaval in our country. And some of it really soul-searching. When Americans are watching on TV what happened in Birmingham with Bull Connor and the hoses and the dogs, you know, that stuff happening. And the assassinations, watching those on TV, first Kennedy, but then later King and Malcolm X and his brother, Kennedy's brother Robert, all of that happening and people seeing it, you know, feeling much more proximity to these events, watching Vietnam, you know, on TV. Someone over here said TV as a significant thing in this era, and it really was in terms of the country experiencing emotionally all of these. And then the whole Watergate dynamic. So all of these happening and kind of coming to a culmination and almost like a national exhaustion in the early 70s. The 60s radical countercultural kind of petering out. Something really interesting happened in relationship to the sort of civil rights trajectory and radical black activism. And that, anyone remember the name Daniel Patrick Moynihan? Famous senator, very, very, very significant senator in that era. And he worked with Nixon on a proposed policy which he called benign neglect. And this was their proposed solution to black radicalism and the riots in the urban centers in the late 60s and early 70s. And their idea was basically just to withdraw services, to withdraw police, fire, healthcare, just to sort of pull out and let the inner cities collapse on themselves, let the people kill themselves. And they did that. That Nixon signed on the memo from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, "I agree!" exclamation point. There's this sort of, in a sense, shifting that happens. This was just before the whole Watergate fiasco and his resignation. So I'm just trying to paint a picture of all these dynamics happening that have an emotional tenor on the country. Those of you who are living through this era, what did it feel like to you? The sort of end of the Vietnam War era, Watergate era. How are you feeling if you can think back to that moment in time?
There wasn't much trust. I didn't.
Not much future, lack of trust.
I felt relieved that the war was over.
Mm-hmm. Relief that the war was over?
Uh-huh. Because I was right at, so by the time the guys that I knew would have turned 18, the war was over. I was just graduating from high school at that
time. Yeah.
So it was a great relief. Okay,
right.
We don't have to worry about the draft.
Right. What else? Anyone else a feeling or a remembrance about that particular era, first half of the 70s? Yeah.
Well, I remember we moved from Milwaukee out to Oconomowoc in Wisconsin, which meant we moved from an area, we were the first ones to sell our home in 1972 to a black family in our neighborhood. And my best friends, we have never talked since then. And there's a strong sense of justified racism. We wouldn't have even called it racism. That was what was right.
Hmm. Yeah, Chuck.
Yeah, I lived in suburban Detroit and remember the riots in 67 as a kid and the fear that that brought and how that was. I look back at some of the news clippings because it's on, was it the 50-year mark? And boy, that brought up some fear.
Yeah.
And I think that was instilled somehow by seeing the National Guard at the end of our neighborhood, that trying to let that spread into the suburbs. And I was definitely tilted in a black direction, fear of the black community that could spread here. So that brought up all those feelings looking at, you know, that were embedded in there from that time.
I didn't want to put up a picture of someone. I don't know. There's a really, I think at the end of the Vietnam War protest, there's a really horrific thing that happens at Kent State with four people being killed and others being shot by, like, they were basically all white students shot by the white National Guard at Kent State. That's another feature of the fear, I think, at that moment. Like, where is this going? You know, what's next? When the protesters often were putting, you know, there's all these iconic pictures of the protesters putting flowers in the guns. Mm-hmm. Someone back here, a feeling, yeah.
I'm not sure if my three kids that are now in their mid-50s have yet forgiven their dad for dragging them in to watch live on TV the Nixon resignation.
Huh.
That was a profound moment.
Yeah.
And we really exactly
what
was going to happen.
Yeah.
In terms of our government.
Yeah. Well, beautiful. Thank you for throwing in your thoughts. The kinds of reflections I just heard really lift up the response that I'm going to point to now. And I think it's so fascinating that the number one hit single in 1974 in the U.S. was Sunshine on My Shoulders, John Denver. And it's no surprise that that song, he released it in 72 on his album Poems and Prayers and Promises, but then he released it as a single in late 1973, and in 1974 it just went boom, became a huge number one single of the year. And it really makes, if you listen to the Say Anyone Want to Sing With Me, sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy. See? So we needed that as a country. We needed that song.
Excuse me. The economy was also very soft in the early 70s.
Yeah.
My dad was unemployed, and I remember that was not easy to find work in. You had a really go-go 50s and 60s, and the 72, 73...
Great.
Plateaued.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people looking for work.
Yeah.
The oil embargo.
Perfect. That's so helpful. So here's this song that's kind of a be happy song. Things are going to be okay. And then what happens is Michael Landon says, what America needs is this hardscrabble pioneer story that's going to have a can-do attitude and help us pull ourselves together, find our morals again. You know, interesting, just as an aside, Laura and her daughter Rose started writing the Little House books in the aftermath of the New Deal in the 1930s and 40s against government support for struggling Americans. They thought, by gosh, people should just work hard and persevere and they'll succeed without government interference. So the original books were written in the context of an era of the country struggling. And then the TV show is introduced at a time of real national struggle. So watch the intro to the television show. Many of you have already seen it, but just get the feel of how the show opened. First Earth Day was what, 70?
1970. And I have to credit my oldest son for his recent graduate work thinking about how we thought about the environment and environmentalism. And, you know, who in this room doesn't like John Muir? And yet, suburbia, we're going to get to places where there are gardens and we're going to leave behind the mess.
Yeah.
And John Denver, nice kid from suburban Twin Cities, extols the Rocky Mountains. We're all
right.
Heading to the Rocky Mountains. Because we're not going to take care of where we live, we're going to go someplace else.
Right.
That's beautiful for students. And I would say that.
Interesting. So just to summarize that, if you couldn't hear what Libby was saying, the environmental movement sort of getting its contemporary launch in the 70s, first Earth Day in 1970, Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring in 1966 or something, 65. And the impulse of that movement, even John Denver as a part of it, Rocky Mountain High, you know, was to leave the sort of troubled urban space and go out into the, find the pristine, find the wilderness, find the and save the wilderness. And Libby's saying, and even this in the 70s kind of played into that, like where can we find space and where can we find sort of good land and not the destroyed spaces of the urban centers and so forth. So it has a particular implicit argument going on in it about where we should want to be. And this is at a time when it's been a decade or more since the majority of Americans lived in the suburbs. Isn't that interesting? What did that feel like to you, just watching the intro? The music, the faces, the spirit of it?
Everyone looks clean and rested.
They do look clean and rested. I don't think they probably were, actually. Clean and rested.
Well, and this was also right before the bicentennial.
It was, that's right.
All the hoopla about kind of looking back at American history and the myth of the frontier.
Yeah.
Amongst other pieces of history.
Yeah. Good.
They're frolicking down the hill. That's what I always think with that just iconic music playing.
There's a fun, kind of free-spirited, just unleashed.
Michael Landon was Western royalty coming from the band.
Sure.
Yeah, yes, right. Yes,
yes. He was clued in on that whole Western frontier.
That's a great connection. He was on Bonanza, that's right. So people knew him in a kind of iconic American, American way, yeah, survival, yeah.
The kids don't need protection. They're safe.
There's no fence.
No adults with them.
Yeah,
there's a
book out recently that, and I can't recall which one of the actresses, I don't know if it was Melissa Gilbert or one of the others, but this is just in the last 4 weeks, about growing up on the set and very much the view that she had compared to other actors or actresses that grew up on sets that had children on them in the 70s is Michael Landon set up a very different environment.
Yeah.
In terms of a hardworking environment, ethics, you know, the teaching, you know, for them to be doing their grades and everything. And to this day, I mean, she kind of credits that with shaping a lot of her life and the lives of other families, mm-hmm. because you didn't see any of these stories like you see with, you know, child actors on other
right.
programs and everything else, because it was very much a family. And I think part of that, for whatever his motivation was, it also was reflected in the actors and actresses, you know, as kind of an ensemble
right.
crew, because I know my own sisters, you know, would always watch that,
yeah.
Despite what the brothers wanted to watch. It wasn't necessarily that, you know, it'd be like combat or something we'd want to watch, but, you know, to them, that was always part of it, is, you know, my sisters always felt a connection with the way they interacted with the other girls, and to them, that was very important, you know, even the one that they'd always be bickering with or something.
Yeah.
Nellie Olson.
Yeah, in the back.
I was just thinking about the fact that it seems like at the time there was also kind of this romance of getting back to the land.
Yeah.
The communes, people trying to live off the grid.
Right.
So it's kind of a modern back to the pioneer
land. Yeah.
Version.
Yeah, no, and there was... Coming out of the 60s, there were these sort of How to Survive in the Woods
right,
Bibles
right.
that were published and yeah. people moving off the grid in Vermont. And yeah, absolutely. The Waltons. When did the Waltons happen? That's interesting. Same period of time.
Earlier.
Yeah.
But the same period of time was also Good Times in Archie Bunker.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Glenn.
I mean, through this kind of the space program.
Oh, right.
Modern-day pioneers. We were going to go to the moon or something.
That's right.
Cool.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is, I think, an uncomfortable next step, perhaps. But one of the arguments that contemporary scholars reading the Little House on the Prairie series, one of the arguments they make is based on the influence that Rose... Laura's daughter had on the series, taking the series in a direction of this anti-government, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, individualist kind of ideology. And she ended up being one of the godmothers of the Libertarian Party in the U.S., very invested in a particular kind of political agenda, which she used the books to promote. And you can see that I'm just doing basically an unfolding series this week and next. So Little House on the Prairie and By the Shores of Silver Lake are next week. And those, the later books have even like speeches put in Pa's mouth, which sound like a libertarian politician, anti-government rants. You can see Rose's hand really clearly at certain points. Yeah.
Cool, and this is super... depressing to me, but the other piece of that is that because there were no direct descendants and Rose was the only child, all of the money from the whole thing went to the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, they were in the end the beneficiary.
All the money, that's where. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure my dad didn't know that.
But one of the, I think culturally, one of the things that arose out of the reaction to the 60s was the moral majority and Reaganism. And the ideology, the sort of perspective of the can-do pioneer, the sort of positive argument about America played right into that rise of Reagan in America. And this is a picture of Jerry Falwell and Ronald Reagan in the early years of his presidency. And the rise of the religious right as a force in conservative politics really came out of the late 70s. I think the Moral Majority was founded in 1979, so not that long after this moment of sort of John Denver and Little House on the Prairie sort of creating a new cultural moment in the country. And in a sense, when I started on Tuesday, I was referencing Robbie Jones's book, The End of White Christian America, and he really describes in the sweep of the last 50 years the moral majority, the Jerry Falwell-inspired movement, as kind of a last grasp at cultural power on the part of white Protestants. And they really were lockstep religion and politics. And the Christian Coalition was sort of their political arm. That whole movement that arose in the late 70s through the 80s played a role that had a very resonant connection to the way that the pioneer story in Little House on the Prairie was told. And so some of the scholars who look at the stories ask the question in terms of, they use this question about the impact of broad readership. What is the impact in terms of the shaping of a culture when so many people are reading a set of stories which have, not in an explicit way, but clearly present in an implicit way, a certain understanding of what it is to be an American? It's a very interesting argument. And so I just raised the question of this sort of intersection of the stories in our time with a particular white grasping on to dominance in our culture. And that the immigration slide that I showed earlier and the changing demographics in the country just weren't in the end we're gonna prevail in terms of the dynamics of our culture. And I think many people argue that's what happened with the coalition, the diverse coalition of people that came together to elect Barack Obama. This is a picture from Grant Park, the night of the election, and just the mass of people of all different races and colors and creeds all together celebrating the first time that we elected a president from a different racial ethnic background than white. And so that tension is, I think, where we are right now with the broad and growing diversity of the country and this even more intense sort of resurgence and grasping onto the dominance of a historic white Christian culture. And this is kind of an eerie slide, but here's Jerry Falwell Jr. And Donald Trump. It's a very similar picture to the earlier picture. And this insistence of a certain strand of white Protestant Christianity to find politicians, even politicians who don't, in their actions, uphold any of the values of evangelical Christianity, except that Trump promised, "I'll make Christianity powerful again." Literally, over and over again, he promised that to them. This is him at Liberty University basically saying that. Vote for me. This is your last chance to assure Christian dominance in this country. So I guess where I'm bringing us in this thread from the 60s to now is this really incredible moment of clashing between how the historically dominant white culture, which has been predominantly Christian in this country, is interrelating, interacting with the rising number of the population who are immigrants, who are people of color, who are completely diverse in every way, religion, country of origin, either present or historically. And I think the Obama presidency and the Trump presidency represent sort of those tensions. And part of what I'm trying to think through in terms of my own life, Little House in the Suburbs, and living my story now, is what kind of story do I need to tell for the future of the country as I hope for and dream for, as I think God dreams a future for us. I think this theme this summer, beginning together, drawing from this text in Revelation about a new creation, I mean, it makes me think, what does the kingdom of God look like? Tom Witt talks about a friend of his who says the kingdom of God is a multicultural reality. It just is. And so what does it mean for us to live into that kind of future as a nation at a time when we've gotten to the point with this kind of tension between how the historically dominant white population is coping with the changes in our country in relationship to this rising diversity, which will soon become the majority. So let's just stop there, and we have about 10 minutes left, and just get into some conversation about this interpretation and this, the moment we're in what it makes you think in terms of the stories that your family experienced and that you carry with you, and how that interacts with where you think we need to go.
We have to look at that slide.
I know.
You know, it strikes me.
What does this provoke in you?
I just have this feeling that I think back to the first Reformation when they were pulling religion out of the political, you know, clutches of the Catholic Church, that, you know, the indulgences and all that.
Yeah.
And I honestly think it's this second Reformation that I think is coming is going to be the church getting back into politics.
Oh, interesting. In what way? Will the church get back into politics?
You know, I'm sorry, I'm a radical Lutheran.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that it's time for the church to take a stand and say, enough is enough. This guy is just, well, I won't get into political discussion, but I think it's time for churches, the Protestants and every religion, to speak up and say, this is not right, this is not fair, this man is not what we need right now. So
I'm thinking about John Marty's session yesterday, I think, when he was talking about how do we build bridges.
Yeah.
And one of the sort of core arguments of his session was the best bridges we can build are to give a concrete, positive vision for where we think we should go. And then invite,
to bring people together.
And
religions of every culture, it's going to bring them together, so people say.
And you're inviting the church to actually say, yeah, we have a vision for our society, not just for our congregation to grow.
Right, the frozen chosen needs to thaw.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Well, can interesting. I ask where are you from?
I'm actually from Chicago.
Like in Seattle, that is very much happening.
It's happening.
Right. I think it's starting to happen everywhere.
How is it happening in Seattle?
There's rumblings.
Well, first of all, there's a lot of concerted focus on social justice issues within the congregation, and then reaching out to all the faith communities, and there's political action happening. There's where they rally and they go down to Olympia to advocate for certain things.
Yeah.
The churches are involved in the Pride Day parades and all sorts of really visible outreach where, you know, and it's not like standing up and saying something specifically against Trump. That's just all the talk. Just kind of the direction.
Right, the political tenor has to change.
Great. Other reactions to this moment that we're in? Yeah, Deb.
I think it's been very inspiring to talk with John and Connie Marty,
too,
about their ecological direction of their church, the solar panels that they had installed. And so for churches also to be taking, you know, action in that regard for the environment. And I don't know how many people saw parts of the film last night in the Village Center. We only saw a bit of it, but that was an excellent, excellent film. I want to get that domain, even though part of it was in French and wasn't really translated into English, but really showing how communities get together and make a difference by just working together on, you know, different issues, education. There was one segment on a small village in India where someone who of the lowest class becomes mayor, has, you know, communal meetings and really starting to bridge these caste divides.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we need to see examples of these community efforts and emulate them.
Yeah, that's great. And what I use to talk about those local examples is that they're future stories. It's a term taken from therapy, where if you're in a cycle of dysfunction, you can't get out of it if you don't have a story beyond the dysfunction to live into. And you can think about that in a societal sense too, that if we don't have these future stories of how we could be to live into, then it's hard to imagine how to get out of the polarization that we're experiencing right now and the hostility of that. And so these local communities, they're experimenting with what a future story could be for our nation, I think are really important to lift up, to tell those stories in film, to tell them in journalistic pieces and so forth. I just want to mention an example I've learned about recently, which is called the Tri-Faith Initiative in Omaha, Nebraska. You wouldn't necessarily think, oh, I'm going to look for a future story of pluralism and where America's going in Omaha, but that's one of the places it is. A group of civic leaders had the vision of building a site where they co-located a mosque, a synagogue, and a Christian church with an interfaith center in the midst of them, and have them intentionally locate in that site so that they could build an interactive life together across their faith traditions. And this was 12 years ago when they had this vision. They now have a 23-acre landscaped site in Omaha. The mosque is built, the synagogue is built, the church is built, the communities are worshiping there. They're building the interfaith center in the middle, and they're in the process of hiring the first executive director for the interfaith center. And so it's a beautiful story, I think, of a heartland community saying, we're not going to survive together if we don't survive together. What does it look like for us to do that in this community with the people who live in our community? It turns out we have Muslims in our community. We don't know them. And the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims need to show the way. They're certainly not all the diversity that we experience, but it's a beautiful example of a local community saying, we're not waiting for someone else to get there. We're going to figure it out here. And then once we figured out how to live together in a different way, then maybe we'll be able to tell the story for other places.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah, a couple more minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, just one extra layer to that. I was visiting with those folks last year.
Oh, cool.
And this 23-acre site that they have used to be home to a really exclusive country club that very limited who was allowed there.
That's a beautiful backstory, John. Transformational. Other comments, sir? Yeah, please.
I wonder what the immigration projection chart you showed is going to, when do they have to revise that now?
Yeah.
And we have a good friend of ours from Romania, a relative who is an English professor in Pennsylvania, and she's all out of sorts.
Yeah. One of the dynamics of that chart is actual immigration, and another dynamic of it is birth rate differentials. New immigrant groups, on the whole, tend to have many more children than the long-term white population in the U.S., and it's a part of the reason why the demographic shift is happening so fast. It's especially true in the Hispanic community, but it's true in other communities, too. So they're both true, and I don't know how much the immediate policies of the Trump administration are going to impact the overall immigration growth, but I think they'll probably continue. Those numbers will continue to grow, despite his efforts to try and shut it down. Yeah, Tom.
This might be just a really weird observation, but I just started thinking about Poland, and maybe because I first came here in '62 and have been here every of these decades, and there's part of Poland that makes me think of Little House on the Prairie. You know, like Little Chalet in the Valley. Something should come up here for that as sort of an escape from the mess. And I mean, you hear that articulated in some ways, you know, first words, sometimes how great it is to be out in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole other part of Poland that I appreciate it. A commitment to not be a place. To not make people always feel comfortable. From the earliest days, when Will Herzfeld, Pete Carroll, introduced the liberation theology here, international speakers, and Adriana Camino and Rainbow Mouse House, like these efforts throughout the decades to sort of bring more diversity, and I don't know that we've really succeeded in terms of its class and color, but I hope that continues to hold in that. Poland tries to keep honest with its storytelling in a separate place apart, but doesn't let people just sort of have a chalet in the valley experience.
Yeah. There are some beautiful stories, I think, in Holden's history. And in 2 weeks, Abriendo Caminos is happening here. So it's continuing the effort to be connected to the diversity of the world and not apart from it. Yeah. Yeah, Chuck.
Yeah, because I was last say word to that too. Oh, last word. Oh, great. I can't help. I'm still haunted by Gary Mason from a few weeks ago, and from Northern Ireland, and taking a look and risking dismantling our myth of our American history.
Yeah.
That it is tainted in blood and it's tainted in awfulness.
Yeah.
And I guess the story that I was most taken by briefly was how America of the 30s was actually the influence to Hitler and Nazi Germany on how to treat the Jews. Mm-hmm. That the segregation of blacks and whites, not allowing them to marry, how they handled them after to like segregate them. And Hitler, even in his Mein Kampf, took it to the next step of saying, well, the Jews don't have a right to live. But the model for the Nazis was what was going on in America. That's a hard one to hear because that flies totally counter to what, you know, the heroes that you've been painted. So we actually had a part in that. So I guess the getting at the hard and risky business of dismantling some of our false history that we could go forward if we can embrace and look at that more clearly.
Yeah. Well, it's a perfect segue for me to say my session tomorrow is about dismantling some of the mythology of the discovery of America and the whole sort of justification for claiming lands in the era of discovery, which goes back to the Reformation era and some decrees by the Pope that gave the Columbus and the other people who went off in search of lands and treasure, basically permission to claim those lands and basically to either enslave or kill the people that they found. So knowing that history and how that history plays into the legal history of the United States, both laws and Supreme Court rulings that were made that related to land contests, and to the common sense that you see in the Little House on the Prairie books about, of course, when the white people come, the Indians have to leave. So
this idea of American exceptionalism,
right,
and nationalism, which
that's
is
right,
really scary,
and play,
not willing to look at the history honestly.
That plays right into it. Well, thank you for coming today, for engaging Little House in the Suburbs.